This is Fresh Air Weekend. I'm Terry Gross. My guest, Ta-Nehisi Coates, has written his first novel, but the subject matter is connected to stories, issues, and ideas he's written about in his nonfiction. He won a National Book Award for Nonfiction in 2015 for Between the World and Me, which was written in the form of a letter to his son about the different forms of violence young African Americans are especially vulnerable to. Coates' 2014 Atlantic Magazine cover story, The Case for Reparations, led to a national conversation about how to reckon with today's injustices resulting from years of slavery, Jim Crow, separate but equal, and racist housing policies. Coates also relaunched Marvel's comic book series Black Panther before the movie adaptation was made. His new novel, The Water Dancer, is set in slave times. The novel imagines an underground railroad with leaders who have a magical power to help deliver slaves to freedom. The main character, Hiram, is born into slavery. His white father is his owner and the owner of the plantation. His mother, a slave, was sold by Hiram's father when Hiram was a young boy. Hiram's half-brother, Maynard, is white and is therefore Hiram's master, although Hiram is the intelligent one, the reliable one, the strong one, and Maynard is a fool. Let's start with a reading from the opening scene. Hiram is driving Maynard in a horse and carriage on a rainy day. As they cross over a bridge, it collapses beneath them, plunging them into the water. As Hiram struggles to keep from drowning, Maynard pleads for Hiram to save him.
There I was, my own life dangling over the black pit, and now being called to save another. I had on many occasions tried to teach Maynard to swim, and he took to this instruction as he took to all instruction, careless and remiss at the labor, then sore and bigoted when this negligence bore no fruit. I can now say that slavery murdered him, that slavery made a child of him, and now dropped into a world where slavery held no sway, Maynard was dead the moment he touched the water. I had always been his protection. It was I, only by good humor and debasement, who had kept Charles Lee from killing him. And it was I, with special appeal to our father, who'd kept him countless times from wrath. And it was I who clothed him every morning, and it was I who put him to bed every night. And it was I who now was tired in both body and soul, and it was I, out there, wrestling against the pull of the current, against the fantastic events that had deposited me there, and now wrestling with the demand that I, once again, save another, when I could not even conjure the energy to save myself. Help me, he yelled again, and then he cried out, please. He said it like the child he always was, begging, and I noted, however uncharitably, even there in the goose facing my own death, that I had never before recalled him speaking in a manner that reflected the true nature of our positions. Please, I can't, I yelled over the water. We are under the ox.
Thank you for reading that. That's Ta-Nehisi Coates reading from his new novel, The Water Dancer. Ta-Nehisi Coates, welcome back to Fresh Air. So Hiram, the African-American character who is a slave at this point, is saved through a magical power that we'll only come to understand later in the novel. You'd written the Black Panther comic book series, the series that's also the basis for the film Black Panther, and of course there are magical powers in that. Did you borrow some of the thinking of magic and of almost like of superheroes and think, what if some of those powers could have been used in history to save people from slavery?
No. There are two things going on in terms of why that's in the book and why it exists in the book in the way that it does. The first is, you know, who I am, you know, as a kid, you know, came up in Baltimore in the 80s and read a lot of comic books, listened to a lot of hip hop, played a lot of Dungeons and Dragons. My roots are low and pulpy and in fantasy and sci-fi. But there's a second, I think, much more important thing. And that is, you know, in order to write The Water Dancer, before I even knew, you know, that I was writing The Water Dancer, I did a considerable amount of research. And when you look at how African Americans describe themselves during that period, when you look at how they talk about their own escapes from slavery, magic is often very much a part. Frederick Douglass, when he makes his first escape attempt from enslavement on the eastern shore of Maryland, he talks about a dude who gave him a magical root, which he, you know, felt would imbue him with powers. Slaves would talk about in their oral narratives about when running and outwitting the hounds and the dogs, putting graveyard dust in their shoes. If you look at, you know, in Louisiana, the Native Guard, when they die, when one of their commanders died in a battle down there, they held a seance to try to commune with his spirit to bring inspiration. And it just goes on. There are countless examples of that all through the literature. And so what the water dancer does, you know, it invokes, obviously, you know, my own taste. But I think much more important than that, it tries to take a somewhat forgotten tradition in African-American resistance and render it seriously.
So the magic in this novel requires memory and the power of story. Why memory? I mean, because memory is also history. It's like personal memory, and it's also an understanding of the past. Why did you want to make that part of the requirement for conjuring the power?
You know, it's tough for me to answer why. I think probably the honest answer is, at least for the past 10 years, in a lot of my writing, I've thought a lot about memory and why certain things are remembered a certain kind of way. And I've thought quite a bit about the fact that, you know, much of the country's history is premised on forgetting, not remembering certain things. And so it felt sort of natural, actually, to go in that direction, to reach there as a source. Why I did that, I mean, I guess I was just captivated with the idea, you know, of why we remember and why we don't.
But memory is power in your novel.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
Do you think of memory as power?
I do, actually. You know, one of the big, I think, themes, you know, for Hiram is he, because his mother is gone, because his father's actually sold his mother, he starts off the novel in great admiration of his father and in great admiration of the lineage and all of the, you know, sort of things that make the plantation where he's enslaved, Lockless, to be this sort of great place. And even as an enslaved person, he actually admires them. And what he has to come to realize is how much of all those great things that he admires is actually based on not just the exploitation of the enslaved population there, but on forgetting the things that have been done, forgetting how that exploitation actually happens, not seeing it. You know, he talks about being in the house and all the devices and the way the house was designed to obscure slaves from view so that you thought the entire house was powered by some sort of magical force. And what he comes to realize is that, in fact, escaping, you know, all of those accoutrements of high civilization, you know, of great Virginia society is actually the true freedom. It's freeing to live down in the dirt, down in the muck, as he says, as opposed to have to, you know, construct yourself as a kind of god.
He also talks about how the closer you get to the slave owners, to the plantation owners, the closer you see the wealth that they have, the more you understand what they've taken from, he says, the more you understand what they've taken from us.
Yeah, exactly.
And so it's a burden to be close to them and to be near that power because you see what it's cost you.
Yeah, and you see them in a very, very intimate way. And so then you have the ability to assess, you know, is this person actually smarter, you know, than this guy, you know, who I was just down in the fields with? You know, is he somehow, you know, a better person? Is he in any way more entitled to all of these riches? You get to see the degree that in Hiram's case, his enslaver, and specifically his brother, you know, and his father, are directly dependent, you know, upon him and the rest of the enslaved populace, and really can't do anything without them.
To write this book, did you have to imagine what life would have been like if you were a slave? And did you have to imagine if you would have the strength and the endurance and the courage of some of your characters?
I did, but not just the courage and the strength and endurance. I had to imagine the weaknesses, too. I also had to imagine myself as an enslaver. You know, I had to imagine myself as Hiram's father. I had to imagine myself into Hiram's brother. So not just, you know, some of the more admirable characters in the book, because I felt really, you know, strongly and feel really strongly that enslavement is a system. And while there are, you know, some individuals of particular, you know, high courage, courage is not a thing to be counted on when it comes to systems. And so I had to, you know, imagine, you know, Hiram's father, for instance, as a relatively decent dude, as far as, you know, that could go, is a, you know, a dude who loved Hiram about as much as the system would allow.
Because he owns Hiram. He's a slave owner.
He is. He's a slave owner, yes. But at the same time, you know, it's capable of great evil, you know, nonetheless.
So tell me about imagining yourself as a slave owner in order to write the book.
So I feel like that was not maybe as new as it sounded. I think, like, history becomes, and maybe moral problems in general, become really, really easy if you can't see yourself in the people that you condemn. Because then you just get to feel better than people. You know, I would never do X, Y, and Z. You know, we would never do, this and that. But in fact, you know, if you know, at least my investigations of history and my reading, which you often find is people who are absolutely, you know, brilliant sometimes can, you know, totally see the moral failing that they're committing, and yet and still continue to commit the moral failure. I mean, the example that immediately comes to mind is, you know, for research for the book, I went to Monticello. And, you know, a significant part of going to Monticello was grappling with Thomas Jefferson. If you ever want to read the most eloquent denunciation of enslavement by an actual enslaver, you know, it doesn't get much better than Thomas Jefferson's notes on Virginia. Jefferson can explain how, you know, slavery not just robs enslaved people of their due, but actually corrupts the enslavers and actually even corrupts their children. Some beautiful, beautiful passages. Still in all, here's a man who lived luxuriously off of the labor of literally hundreds of enslaved people, and did not, you know, just live in a normal fashion, but lived, you know, in debt, so much so that when he died, actual, you know, people there had to be sold in order to settle his debts. You know, is it that Thomas Jefferson couldn't see what was wrong? You know, is it that Thomas Jefferson was, you know, just a, you know, a person lacking courage? Or is it much more likely that he was a human being who was a child, you know, of people who had enslaved, that who lived in a society in which people enslaved, who had many friends who enslaved, who lived in a state that, you know, was rooted in enslavement? When you can think about it that way, you know, how can you say that you somehow would have necessarily been any different?
So one of the things that you're so well known for is an article that you wrote for The Atlantic in, was it 2014? The Case for Reparations?
Yep, 2014.
And so you use the example of housing discrimination. And I just want to back up and say it's so relevant to what we're talking about now, because your book is about slavery and how it disadvantaged people for centuries. I mean, people are still dealing with the consequences of their ancestors having been enslaved and deprived of money, land, freedom, education, and so on. Their children, their parents, who were sold. So you wrote this article in 2014, The Case for Reparations, and you focused on housing discrimination as an example of white-imposed disadvantage, as you described it. And so that really helped just kind of like restart a big national debate about should there be reparations, and if so, what do we mean by it, and what would that look like? And so every year since 1989, after John Conyers introduced his idea to have a commission to study reparations. Every year, that idea for a commission to study reparations was introduced into Congress. And this year, there was actually a House Judiciary Subcommittee that started talking about that. And you testified at that. And I'm not sure if what I read was an excerpt of the whole thing of your testimony, but what I read focused on Mitch McConnell.
That was most of my testimony, yeah.
So why making your pitch to this House subcommittee about reparations did you want to focus on Mitch McConnell, the Senate
because,
Majority Leader?
Yeah, I had actually started, you know, writing. I knew that, you know, I was going to do a testimony, you know, about a week or two before. And so I'd actually started writing out my testimony. And then somebody asked Mitch McConnell about the hearings. A young African-American reporter asked him the question. And I felt like what he said, which is that, you know, we don't have to, you know, basically we aren't accountable for things that happened 150 years ago. And, you know, we, you know, elected a black president, so therefore we should, you know, be past it. I thought that it was a perfect summary of perfect encapsulation of the argument I wanted to attack. And that is that somehow history or American history is only relevant when it credits Americans. Anytime, you know, it says something bad about the country, it is somehow, you know, oh, that was a long time ago and has no relationship to today.
Have you gotten to the point of thinking about what reparations might look like? Or is your goal just to say, this is something we should be talking about?
The answer is yes to both. yes, I do. Let me take the latter part first. I am trying my best, perhaps somewhat unsuccessfully, to stay out of the world of activism around reparations. It's just not. It's not who I want to be. I want to be a writer. You know, I believe in reparations, but I don't think my talents lie in organization or advocacy or anything like that. I think I'm where I'm supposed to be. At the same time, how can you not think about, you know, what it might would look like? And so I've given some consideration to it. And I think the first thing to understand is that reparations is not unprecedented, that we've actually done this, you know, before. We did it, you know, and I'm sure you've heard this yourself. You know, we did it for Japanese Americans who were interned during the period of World War II. The state figured out how to compensate the victims of that internment. We have a reparations program right now, actually, in Chicago, Illinois, for the victims of a police officer by the name of John Burge, who for, you know, decades tortured African-American men and tortured confessions out of them. And the city of Chicago made a reparations settlement that included cash to the victims, but also included a curriculum so that, you know, school children in Chicago would understand who John Burge was and what the police did, you know, in that era. There's been reparations payments made for massive resistance in Virginia. When the state of Virginia effectively, or certain counties in the state of Virginia, basically shut down the public school system in order to resist Brown versus the board. And so I've always thought about reparations as not merely you take a DNA test and you get reparations, but as a literal suite of claims. It's the reason why I focused on housing discrimination specifically, housing discrimination as a claim for reparations. And I think, like, you know, taken together, you know, like when you think about white supremacy, what you think about is several harms inflicted, you know, upon a group of people, you know, at varying levels. And in my mind, a reparations program takes each harm individually, tries to locate the victims, the people who've actually, you know, been affected by that harm, and then tries to compensate them for it.
What has the impact on your life been of the reparations article?
Oh, that's a great question. Wow. So what I would say is, the case for reparations and Between the World and Me taken together, because one came out one year and the other came out the other year, they, I don't know, it fundamentally changed my life, you know? They made me, boy, it's hard to say this. They made me famous. I mean, as much as any writer can be famous, you know what I mean? As much as any writer can be.
Well, it's true, it's a fact.
Yeah, I mean, I don't like saying it, though.
You're not bragging. It's just, it's a fact.
Right. What you're probably picking up on is my discomfort around that fact. It made me famous. You know, I won't skid around this at all. It gave me a level of you know, financial stability that I had never, like, you know, come close to, you know, or touched or imagined. And what that meant was that I could do things like go off and finish a novel like this. You know, it meant that, you know, the way I saw my work was fundamentally different. I could, you know, now really, really imagine what do I actually want? What do I actually, you know, want to do, as opposed to going from story to story or book to book? I think it changed how people saw me. I think sometimes because of that, you know, fame and celebrity, people probably attribute more qualities to me than I am in the possession of. A lot of times people think because you're intelligent or smart about one thing, and you're famous, so a lot of people see you be intelligent and smart and wise on one thing, they necessarily assume that you are smart and wise on all things, or that you have the ability to speak on all things. And, you know, that just is not the case. What I do is much more based in, you know, research and trying to understand than it is in, like, snap analysis, you know, looking at a situation and saying this is what it is. I'm actually not that quick. You know, I'm not a particularly quick thinker. I'm a much slower thinker. But that might not be obvious, you know, when I'm talking about something that I've thought about for a really, really long time. And so I said it to say that it probably imposed, you know, things, you know, on me that I was not particularly comfortable with. But at the same time, you know, you get some good and you get some bad. You know, there's no, you know, unalloyed blessing. There's no, you know, good thing that happens and then not, you know, responsibilities that come with it.
So you have to have to be clear with people about what you're not going to do because it's not where your talent lies or where your interest lies or where your heart is?
Yeah, all the time. And they look at me like I'm crazy. They look at me like I'm crazy. Like, they're like, what? You know what I mean? And when you say that, like, they think you're, like, putting them off or blowing them off or something. But I listen, you know, for better or worse, I'm a writer, you know? And I don't. You know, I don't have much else. I'm not particularly good at politics. I can't really work a room. You know what I mean? I'm not, you know, good, you know, at parties filled with people I don't know. That's not what I do. I'm not, you know, really good at talking to people and building consensus, you know, between, you know, broad groups of people. You know, I'm not an academic. I don't have much talent at, you know, designing, you know, programs, you know, to end, you know, great evils. And so, yeah, I have my limitations. You know, and I'm okay with that. You know, I'm okay with that. I am deeply honored that people look and maybe see more than I see. At the same time, I think it's really important to know your lane.
Ta-Nehisi Coates, it's been great to have you back on the show. Thank you so much.
Thanks for having me, Terry.
Ta-Nehisi Coates' new novel is titled The Water Dancer. The new biopic, Judy, stars Renee Zellweger as the singer and Hollywood star Judy Garland during the final months of her life. Judy Garland was 47 when she died in London in 1969. Our film critic Justin Chang has this review.
Academy Awards voters can rarely resist a celebrity impersonation, judging by some of the star turns that have won Oscars in recent years. These aren't just performances, they're jaw-dropping feats of mimicry. Gary Oldman is Winston Churchill. Rami Malek is Freddie Mercury. The new film Judy is being sold along similar lines. Renee Zellweger is Judy Garland. To judge by the breathless hype that has greeted the movie so far, the approach seems to be paying off. What makes Judy unusually fascinating for an otherwise standard celebrity biopic is that Zellweger isn't Judy Garland. Her transformation is impressive, but hardly definitive. Even with the help of a dark wig and skillful makeup and prosthetics, she doesn't exactly disappear into the role of the beloved singer and actress who captivated the public in movies like The Wizard of Oz and Meet Me in St. Louis. But even if you don't always believe you're in the presence of Garland, Zellweger nearly makes up in raw emotional commitment what she lacks in verisimilitude. Her intensely felt, go-for-broke performance sometimes runs the risk of overwhelming this sturdy screen adaptation of Peter Quilter's stage play, End of the Rainbow. Judy begins with one of several flashbacks to the teenage Garland on the set of The Wizard of Oz, showing us how the industry created and destroyed her in the same breath. Her body and image are ruthlessly controlled by the powerful MGM studio head, Louis B. Mayer, who puts her on a strict diet and gives her barbiturates and amphetamines, setting in motion the substance abuse problem that she will struggle with for the rest of her life. But most of the movie is set in 1969, long after her Hollywood heyday and mere months before her death at the age of 47. Judy is now broke and virtually homeless, dragging herself from one crummy LA club performance to another. We meet her eldest child, Liza Minnelli, at a house party, and also Judy's third husband, Sidney Luft, who takes custody of their two young children while she reluctantly books a gig at the Talk of the Town nightclub in London. Although she's devastated at being separated from her kids, Judy has little choice but to work overseas, where her fans can still be counted on to turn out in full force. In London, Judy's depression and insomnia quickly take over. She pops pills, skips rehearsals, and nearly misses opening night. But once she stumbles into the spotlight and starts crooning By Myself and the trolley song, her confidence comes surging back, and she enjoys having an appreciative crowd again. One night after a show, Judy, feeling lonely, befriends an adoring couple, Stan and Dan, and joins them for a late dinner at their apartment. In a touching scene, Dan, played by Andy Nyman, reminds Judy how much she means to her many gay fans.
It's sweet that you come to see me. Sometimes I spy the two of you out there. I feel like I have allies.
Well, we missed you in 64, so...
I couldn't get tickets?
Not together, no. Stan was otherwise engaged. 6 months for obscenity.
In jail?
They've changed the law since then. Turns out we didn't do anything wrong after all.
They hound people in this world. Anybody who's different. They can't stand it. Well, to hell with them.
The director, Rupert Gould, has a deft way with actors. He gets a lovely performance from Jesse Buckley as Judy's London handler, Rosalind Wilder, always there to lend an ear and keep her on schedule. Finn Wittrock plays the aggressively charming music entrepreneur Mickey Deans, who becomes Judy's fifth and final husband. Their tempestuous union does a number on Judy, who suffers a few drunken onstage meltdowns before rebounding with a climactic performance of Over the Rainbow that might just reduce you to tears. It's a dazzling showcase for Zellweger, whose commitment is astonishing even when the illusion doesn't always seize hold. While the actress has a sweetly quavering singing voice, she makes no effort to match Garland's warm, velvety contralto, reportedly at the instruction of the director himself, who rightly guessed that it would be smarter to channel Garland than to imitate her. Curiously, Zellweger's physical resemblance to Garland is most pronounced when the camera catches her in profile. She wears the character like a mask that keeps slipping. There's something poignant about that, since Garland herself struggled to live up to a persona constructed for an audience that could love her one minute and turn on her the next. Zellweger herself knows something about what it's like to be chewed up and spat out by the industry machine. After her earlier triumphs in movies like Chicago and Cold Mountain, for which she won an Oscar, she struggled for the next decade to find decent roles, endured much sexist mockery from the entertainment press, and only recently returned to filmmaking after a 6-year hiatus. Her empathy for her subject is apparent in every scene. Renee Zellweger may not be Judy Garland, but she reminds us that technical perfection is no match for emotional truth.
Justin Chang is a film critic for the LA Times. He reviewed the new film Judy, starring Renee Zellweger as Judy Garland. Coming up, we hear from music collaborators and identical twins, Tegan and Sarah. Their new memoir is about their high school years, a turning point in their lives when they started making music and started falling in love with girls. This is Fresh Air Weekend. This is Fresh Air Weekend. I'm Terry Gross. My guests, Tegan and Sarah, are twins and musical collaborators, singer-songwriters who have won awards for their music and for their advocacy of LGBTQ issues. They've won 3 Juno Awards, the Canadian equivalent of the Grammys, and they've received a Grammy nomination. They were honored by the New York Civil Liberties Union. Their album Heartthrob was on our rock critic Ken Tucker's top 10 list in 2013. Tegan and Sarah have written a new memoir called High School about their lives when they were in high school. It was a tumultuous period when they each started falling in love with girls and when they started writing and recording songs. There was a lot of tension between the twins as they tried to create separate identities while also collaborating on music. Their memoir ends in 1998 when they turned 18 and signed a contract with PolyGram Records. Tegan and Sarah have released a new CD that's a companion to their memoir. It's called Hey, I'm Just Like You, and it features songs they wrote as teenagers. They describe it as a record they never could have made as teenagers, full of songs they never could have written as adults. Let's start with a song from the new album. It's called I'll Be Back.
Sit and watch my TV set.
Keegan, Sarah, welcome to Fresh Air. It is a pleasure to have you on the show.
We're so delighted to be here, Terry. Thank you so much.
Were you afraid about going back and, you know, revisiting songs that you wrote as teenagers and then recording them? When I look at things I wrote when I was in high school, I actually have some things I wrote when I was in high school. I have them deeply hidden in boxes, in closets, and there are so many things on top of those boxes I can't possibly ever get to it. I'm not quite ready to burn it, but God forbid I should ever actually look at it. So what was it like for you to revisit early songs?
When we were writing the memoir, Tegan was sort of the initiator in finding some of our archival materials, like the audio recordings, the VHS tapes that we had from high school of ourselves hanging out with friends in that school. I was more reluctant, and I think my sort of takeaway from both the memoir and the album and that general time period is that I have a lot more self-loathing, insecurity, and shame than Tegan does, and
a lot more.
And I have the therapy bills to prove it, but. Yeah, I was really reluctant to listen to the songs from high school, and Tegan had to do quite a hunt to find them. We hadn't kept our original demo tapes, and so she ended up sort of scrambling around asking friends and friends of friends, and when she did eventually find them, she had them digitized and sent me the audio, like MP3s, and I avoided listening to them. I think I share a sort of social similarity or anxiety that a lot of us have. I didn't want to look back at the reality. I preferred my memories, and I preferred editing my memories, and I don't know, I was afraid that I would hear something that I would be embarrassed by or ashamed of. And the truth is that when I finally did listen, I was struck by the joy in our voices and our early recordings. And I actually felt a lot of grief in a way, because I think that that insecurity that I sort of had been carrying around with me was not real. You know, we were great. And we were writing these really sophisticated, adventurous songs as teenagers. And that was why we ended up signing a record deal as teenagers and starting our career. And I don't know why I allowed myself to believe that there wasn't something of value for us to write about or think about.
Tegan, were you as afraid to look back as Sarah was?
I was not, Terry. I think, yeah, as Sarah said, I think we had really...
Tegan stole all our self-confidence in the womb.
She just siphoned it. She got all the food and I got all the confidence. I'm definitely self-conscious about some of what I created, but some of what Sarah created from that time has stuck with me the last 20 years. I think Sarah had developed a sense of songwriting and had already established herself as a very specific kind of songwriter at that age, and it's something she's kept consistent through the last 20 years. I think Sarah's always been spectacular at saying a lot with very little, and I think she was able to do that even as a teenager. Her first songs had profound meaning to me at that time.
So what you're saying is I peaked. I peaked in high school.
Well, you've sustained a certain... you hit the summit and you've sustained. And I think for me, most of my cringing was over more of my music than hers. And the joy and the enthusiasm I felt listening to Sarah's material is what really inspired me to push us to finish the book and then immediately record these songs for a new record.
So the book is called High School, and it's about when you were in high school. And that's a difficult time for most people. And during high school, it's one of the periods of your life, of everybody's life, I think, when you're trying to figure out who are you, how do you fit in with other people, and how do you differentiate yourselves from other people? That's kind of standard high school things. Did being twins make it more complicated to figure out not only where you fit in, but how to differentiate yourself, not only from other people, but from each other?
I think that's one of the most significant, you know, through lines for us in our life, not just in high school, but the experience of being twins. We didn't have other siblings at the time. So, you know, our whole experience from birth until today has always been, okay, we are sisters, and we share a face, and we share a birthday. We share a sort of common interest or common place in the world. And in some ways, there was power in being twins. And then there was also, in some cases, like a terrible inconvenience. And sometimes it was, you know, like there was this this invasion of privacy. Sometimes it was physical. Since we were little kids, I mean, I always like to say that in some ways we were famous since we were born. I mean, people would, my mom and dad would separate us at the mall, and one would take one of us and the other would take the other, because, you know, people would come up and touch us at the mall and talk to us and look at us. And
because you were so identical?
Because we were so identical, and we were adorable, Terry. I mean, we were very cute.
No doubt.
But it wasn't just that we looked the same. I mean, but, you know, I seriously think that in some ways, even as small children, we understood that there was a way to use our twinness, like the, you know, for good. And then there was ways that it was really inconvenient. And I think it caused, you know, at least I know for myself, more so than Tegan, I've talked about it as almost like a burden. In some ways, the origin of my insecurity. I never knew if people really liked me. I always thought, oh God, do they only like me because I'm part of this thing, this identity.
And
with
I
my
was
sister.
Like grabbing Sarah and shoving her out in front of new people and being like, and I'm a twin.
Yes, I did feel Tegan exploited us sometimes, but in some ways it really made us uniquely qualified to be musicians and to be public people. And you know, in high school, I remember it was particularly complicated because I had started to, I mean, my sort of questioning of my identity and sexuality started in elementary school. And I never, of course, shared this with Tegan or spoke about it with her. I was really ashamed. I was really scared about what I sort of started to kind of understand about myself. And I remember in high school, that was just like the breaking point. I had started to have romantic sexual relationships with girls in secret. And Tegan scared me because I knew she understood what was probably happening with me. And I was afraid because I think I knew that that was going to happen to her too, that she was going to be gay. And then there was no way for me to control how to, like, I couldn't protect myself because it wasn't just me who was gay. It was Tegan who was gay also. And I remember feeling a sort of resentment and fear about the fact that there was two gay people to protect, not just one.
So your aunt suggested that you enter a competition at an area college, and the winner of the music competition was going to get hours of time in a recording studio and the possibility of a contract afterwards. So you entered the contest, you were the youngest ones in the contest, you won, you were 16 at the time,
I think? 17.
17, yeah. Mm-hmm. Then by the time you were 18, as soon as you became legal and could sign a contract, you signed a contract with PolyGram. And so another big turning point in your lives. I think, judging from your book, it was also a big turning point in differentiating yourselves more from each other. And Tegan, something that you say in the book, you say, a lifetime of calibrating myself alongside Sarah ended abruptly. And this was about the same time period. So what ended it, and in what sense did you feel you were always calibrating your life alongside Sarah's?
Well, we always joke that when you meet twins, there's always one that really wants to be in the twin ship, and then there's the one that's always trying to escape, and Sarah's always trying to escape. And I think that, you know, starting with the fracture that happened when her and Naomi got together, I had sort of been clinging to Sarah for dear life. I'd always really relied on her. I'd always been really proud of the fact that we were twins. And when we started making music, it was like, great, Sarah and I will be together forever now, making music together. And as Sarah, you know, struggled more and more with her identity, and we got closer to the end of high school, it was like she was withholding that option from me. That's what it felt like at times. You know, she was very, very much in love with someone, and that person was going to go out to Toronto, and Sarah talked about maybe going with her, and my mom had been pushing us to enroll in university, and neither of us had wanted to. And then the second we won that competition, my mom said, all right, kind of gave us her blessing to spend a year focused on music. And immediately Sarah started talking about going to university. And I just, I felt like she was withholding our dream from me. But in a way, we became very angry and at odds with one another. But also, I started to just kind of climb out of this prison that I had sort of put us in together. And I realized, well, if Sarah doesn't want that, then I'm going to go get it. And I'm going to be this. You know, I cut all my hair off. I started to speak openly about moving away after school. I was going to move to Vancouver. I was going to sign a record deal. I was going to do all these things. I had uncovered who I was. And I started to just see myself as an individual, see myself as my own person, not in a relationship with Sarah, like as sisters anymore, or in a band, which of course was all crap because actually deep down inside, I was desperate for Sarah to agree to do this and I needed her and I knew I needed her, but I just thought, well, I'm going to push through and I'm going to make this happen anyway. And, you know, thankfully Sarah agreed to sign the deal and move to Vancouver and be in a band.
Still thinking about going back to university now.
At what point did you decide to come out publicly, and how did you decide to do it?
We never did. We just really looked gay. And I just don't think anyone, like, there was not, I mean, there was a handful of interviews we did in high school where we were 17-year-old high school students who just won a competition. You know, the questions weren't very probing. I mean, it was very like, what do your boyfriends think? You know, that sort of thing. I mean, I can remember very distinctly thinking, okay, I can't do this. I can't lie. I can't pretend that these songs I'm writing that are obviously love songs are about boys. Like, I really remember feeling that way. And again, it wasn't something Tegan and I discussed, but when we got out of high school, we took the long road and we ended up signing with Neil Young. And he had a little label called Vapor Records, and it was perfect for us at the time. There was a lot of discussion around, you will find your voices, you will tour the world, you will cut your teeth on big stages and little stages, you'll take the Greyhound, you will learn how to be musicians, you will build a career, and you will write your best music in your 30s and 40s. Take your time. And I remember being really nervous but excited about the opportunity. And one of the first things that happened was someone from the record label called and said, we have a couple of big pieces of news for you. One, Neil Young is going to take you on tour. We were 20 years old. And you're going to tour all across the U.S. with him, opening his show. And we're also going to get you guys a publicist, and you're going to start doing press. And I remember one of the first rounds of press we did was with gay press. And I remember them saying, like, whatever it was at the time, like, I don't know if it was Out Magazine, but it was like, this
no,
is...
it was a magazine called Lesbian News.
Lesbian News. So pretty obvious.
And they put us on the cover.
And I remember saying to Tegan's, like, it was actually just called You're Gay and We Have a Gay Magazine for you to do. But so I remember calling, we had like a conference call with the label, and I remember being really nervous, and I remember saying,
which the label was
three people.
One was Neil Young's manager, Elliot Roberts.
Yes. And I remember, so we're on the phone with a couple of people from the label and Elliot Roberts, Neil Young's manager, and I remember having to work myself up to it, but I said, is it okay if we do this gay press? And they were like, of course. And we were like, is it okay that we're gay? Can we talk about our sexuality? And, like, you know, I remember Elliot saying, like, are you gay? And we were like, yes. And he was like, then you can talk about it. And we were like, what if it hurts our career? And he was like, what career? Like, you don't have a career yet. There's nothing to hurt. And I remember feeling such tremendous relief that they were accepting us as we were.
I also want to point out that this is, you know, late 90s, early 2000s. Talking about being queer or gay was like hot potato.
Oh, yeah.
You'd lob that at someone and they would just be like so ready to get it out of their hands.
Yeah,
you know?
Like, you take it.
Yeah, nobody really, really wanted to dive in, as Sarah said. It wasn't an era of deep probing from journalists. It was very much, you're twins, you're from Canada, Neil Young signed you, end of interview, next interview, you're twins, you're from Canada, Neil Young signed you. And I think we were glad for the space to find our language, you know?
Yeah.
So it must have been great to tour with Neil Young.
It's so funny because it was an amazing experience, and we were absolutely thrilled, but we were 19. So
20.
You know, sorry, we were 20. So we cared. You know, career-wise, we understood the significance of what was being offered. The direct support on the tour was the Pretenders. I mean, we were living some sort of dream, and we knew it. But we were also, you know, opening. You know, people are getting their seats with beer and nachos.
It's telling, like, us to take our shirts
older
off.
Older guys, yeah, like, oh, yelling, nice. Free bird. And, you know, and then they'd put us in a golf cart after we played to a nearly empty house and make us play in the beer gardens. And then we'd get in the van to drive 15 hours to chase the tour. And it was hard. Sarah and I were, you know, just had moved to Vancouver. We were both in new relationships. I think we were really lonely. You know, there was no Wi-Fi, no internet. No one wanted to hear about this, by the way. Everyone would cut us off and be like, but it was amazing, right? You were having the time of your lives. And I'm like, I don't know. We took 3 Polaroids. We kind of looked depressed. But we were thrilled. I mean, We learned a lot.
We learned a lot.
And we learned how to run a business, and we learned how to be good every night, and we learned to show up and have a good attitude, and we learned to be grateful.
We got really good at dealing with catcalling. Like, you know, I mean, this
we acquired a lot of skills.
We did. Like, I mean, we laugh about it. There was trauma involved. I don't want to downplay what it was like to have like 60-year-old men tell us to take our shirts off. We were 20 years old. I mean, it was awful. But on the other hand, it did give us this kind of clever, quick wit that we had to employ on stage. And I think it made people like us and root for us. And I'm not saying that I'm glad it happened, or I mean, of course, I wish that the tour had felt different in terms of like the way that the audience had responded to us. But on the other hand, I can't deny that we did learn from
Well, after that tour, we also did a cross-Canadian tour of small clubs, and they were sold out. And I'll tell you, it made me appreciate our audience, and I also appreciate that no matter if there's 50 people in the audience or 100, if they're there for you, it feels extraordinary. And I think we learned that lesson very quickly, that
we wanted our own audience.
We wanted our own audience, and we would appreciate them and work hard to keep them.
Tegan and Sarah, thank you so much. It was really such a pleasure to talk with you. Thank you so much.
Thank you.
Tegan and Sarah's new memoir is called High School. Their new CD, featuring new recordings of songs they wrote as teenagers, is called Hey, I'm Just Like You.
Stranded and I'm so lost, my mind.
Fresh Air Weekend is produced by Teresa Madden. Fresh Air's executive producer is Danny Miller. Our technical director and engineer is Audrey Bentham. Our interviews and reviews are produced and edited by Amy Sallet, Phyllis Myers, Sam Brigger, Lauren Krenzel, Anne-Marie Baldonado, Roberta Shorrock, Muj Zaidi, Thea Chaloner, and Seth Kelly. Molly C.V. Nesper is our associate producer of digital media. I'm Terry Gross.